exercise the federal government's powers of peace, order, and good government versus the provincial powers relating to property and civil rights. In front of lordships, the matters for justiciability was the validity of Canada Temperance Act. Canada Temperance Act was passed by the federal parliament to regulate the sale of liquor in the Dominion. The main issue is to see if the Canada Temperance Act was intravirus or ultravirus. So the person who brought the case, his name is Charles Russell. He was charged with unlawfully selling intoxicating liquor in New Brunswick. So the appeal was filed to the Judicial Committee of Privy Council. The challenge was the conviction of Russell, not on his conviction of selling the alcohol itself, but he was challenging the very validity of the law itself that was governing the sale and the sale of liquor in New Brunswick. So I found two legal terms that were totally foreign to me. One was Rule Nisi, and the other one was, please correct me, Professor, if I'm wrong.
Certiorari.
So the Rule Nisi means, as I have researched, according to that, it means to show a cause in front of the Judicial Committee of Privy Council that the conviction based on the particular law of Canada Temperance Act was not valid. And certiorari means that a writ that seeks judicial review of the conviction and then to send it back to the lower court for an order. So the act actually authorizes any town or parish to regulate the sale of liquor based on the federal parliament's regulations in the act established that if the town or parish agree with majority, they can authorize somebody to sell liquor within their jurisdiction. So Charles Russell was selling liquor in the city of Fredericton in New Brunswick. So before that, a case as presented by URA, the Judicial Committee of Privy Council took an approach that what they did was they actually started a process of judicial review of Canada Temperance Act in of an order of the Supreme Court of Canada that was given in the case of City of Fredericton versus the Queen. So it's really new, given that the Canada, Canadian Federalism and Canadian Confederation was established in 1867, and the Canada Temperance Act was passed in 1878, and in 1882 we have this case in front of the Judicial Committee of Privy Council. So Judicial Committee of Privy Council took up the case, and then the decision was given on behalf of lordships by Sir Monteague Smith. So the Russell was challenging that the act in the province was ultra-virus because the federal parliament did not have power to regulate the sale of liquor based on provincial powers of property and civil rights. So Judicial Committee of Privy Council used pith and substance doctrine theory, and they issued their judgment based on that doctrine. So in their decision, they clarified that since Charles Russell did not challenge his conviction, he's only challenging the validity of the act, of Canada Temperance Act, and they based their decision, and they gave following reasons for giving their decision of overturning of maintaining the Russell's conviction. So what they said in their decision was that since the federal government used peace, order, and good governance, to enact the law, they went back in judicial review and put this under residual power rather than peace, order, and good governance. So one of the main factors is that judicial review actually overturned the previous decision that they had in the city of Fredericton versus the Queen. So that order was reviewed, and then they further stated that this act is not under property or civil rights. So appellant's lawyer stated that under subsection 9, 13, 16th of property and civil rights, section 92 clauses, this act is not affected by those property and civil rights clauses. So then they further stated that it is a matter of public order and safety in the whole dominion and not necessarily a provincial matter. And then they further validated it. And then they clarified the scope of law and stated that the scope of law is that the main substance is the whole of dominion. The central point is for the government to actually make sure that intoxicating liquor does not have negative effects on the population as a whole. So that's why they overruled the presentation of Russell's lawyers. So that's the main theme of the case. Now the questions what I came up with are why the act is valid under residual power and not under Section 91 of Trade and Commerce. Because Supreme Court in their judicial review stated that this law is valid as a residual power of the federal parliament and not under Trade and Commerce as it was previously passed and then held up in the City of Fredericton versus the Queen case. And then the second question is why the Supreme Court of Canada wasn't directly discussing the decision. Supreme Court of Canada's decision wasn't discussed directly by the Judicial Committee of Privy Council. The third question is why did the Judicial Committee of Privy Council conduct judicial review? What was the need for that judicial review? And what are the implications of this decision? So.
Wonderful presentation, thank you very much. And to stay here for a minute, and all of those questions are good. I'd like to get to them in a minute. This case is a little confusing because it refers to the city city of Fredericton versus the Queen. Now, the Supreme Court of Canada had recently been created, and as I mentioned last month, people could appeal from the Provincial Court of Appeal to the Supreme Court of Canada, and from there to the Judicial Committee of the Privy Council if they wished. Or they could go directly from their Provincial Court of Appeal to the Judicial Committee of the Privy Council. So the City of Fredericton decision was a Supreme Court of Canada decision about the same issues. There was no appeal to the Judicial Committee of the Privy Council from there, but the Supreme Court upheld the Canada Temperance Act as being within trade and commerce. So Russell's lawyer, rather than going to the Supreme Court, where he would lose, obviously, went directly to the Judicial Committee of the Privy Council and asked, well, let's get to your third question, he asked for judicial review. Judicial review simply is asking a higher court to declare that a government body is acting outside of its jurisdiction. So the argument was that the federal government was acting outside of its jurisdiction in enacting the Canada Temperance Act. So So maybe that answers that part of the question. Why do we have that judicial review? It was because Russell wanted to continue selling liquor. He didn't want to pay a fine or go to jail. I guess he had lots of money to go all the way to London for the appeal. It's interesting that here Sir Montague Smith follows the same line of reasoning that he did in the Parsons case. Let's restrict the interpretation of trade and commerce. Now, he didn't actually overrule the City of Fredericton case, because that wasn't the issue. The issue was judicial review of this particular piece of legislation. And partly because, he doesn't criticize the City of Fredericton Supreme Court of Canada case. Partly because he doesn't want to create trouble and make it look like the Supreme Court of Canada is incompetent. So let's just leave that alone and not deal with it. But let's make a different decision. So I think, first of all, what Smith wanted to do was to say, well, this is how we're interpreting trade and commerce. It's not a really broad power, as some people had thought. But we have to decide the judicial review of this. We have this federal legislation. Now, it's interesting, the federal legislation said that a quarter of the electors in a county or city could petition for a plebiscite on prohibition. And then if the majority voted in favor of prohibition, feds could institute. Now, something else, and this is really important for other cases we'll be deciding. Russell's lawyer also argued that this was an illegal delegation of power from the federal government to local constituents. Now, one of the aspects of the rule of law is that no sovereign legislature can delegate its powers. It has to always have the last say. So any legislation that simply says, well, we're going to have a plebiscite, and if the plebiscite has a certain result, then that's the law. That's unconstitutional, whether it's federal or provincial. So Russell's lawyer said, well, this is an illegal delegation of power by the federal parliament. You're delegating the power to local people to vote. And Smith says, no, that's not a valid argument, because the legislation says that the Governor General may declare prohibition, not shall. If it was shall, yes, it would be illegal. But since there's discretion there, that means the plebiscite is just advisory. And it's really up to Parliament to declare, to instruct the Governor General to have prohibition. So throughout history, there have been laws with regard to plebiscites. So keep in mind that no legislation can ever delegate its powers. Plebiscites are always advisory. They cannot be compulsory. And this is the precedent for that case. And then he said, well, how are we going to decide this then? Well, first of all, we have to ask if a subject matter falls within Section 92. That's what we go first. First of all, we define the subject matter. It's public order and safety. Now, this is really important for the next case. Public order and safety, that's what this is all about. Does it fall anywhere under Section 92? And he says, no, it doesn't fall under Section 92. None of the sections, parts of Section 92 deal with public order and safety. Therefore, it must be somewhere in Section 91. Now, because of the exhaustiveness doctrine, the judges don't have to decide where in Section 91. But it's got to be there somewhere, because it's not in Section 92. It's got to be somewhere in Section 91. Now, Smith is very unclear, and judges often are unclear because they don't want to tie the hands of future judges. So we assume that the federal power over the federal power to enact legislation with regard to public order and safety falls within POGG. He doesn't actually say that, as you pointed out.
Yeah.
But it's been assumed ever since that it's somewhere under peace, order, and good government. Not under the enumerated heads, but the peace, order, and good government preamble to Section 91. Yeah. So this is the first example, and the only example for many years, of the interpretation of peace order and good government as the as a residual clause. If it doesn't fall under Section 92, it's got to fall under somewhere in Section 91, probably POG. And Peter Hogg calls this, and I think Monahan as well, calls it the gap doctrine of peace order and good government. So, what's important about this case? What do you think is important? Once again, yes?
Being in Iraq, importance, that wasn't like an ideological precursor to the emergency doctrine.
That's how Haldane treated it.
I think that if you look at the history of JCPC, JCPC in this case particularly is kind of upholding the federal jurisdiction. That's how it is applied. But in the later on, and in many other cases, JCPC is not really interested in giving federal government unlimited power, and it's kind of, it seems to be from the readings that it's kind of restricting the federal government actually going into provincial jurisdiction. So this case is important in that way, that it is kind of one of the only few cases where JCPC is kind of giving federal government a really great leeway in the application of their jurisdiction into provincial matters. So that's what my understanding.
Yeah. This is the high point for the interpretation of peace, order, and good government for many decades. And we'll see how this interpretation begins to be turned back in the local prohibition case, which we'll discuss right now. Any other questions about Russell? Good. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you, Professor.
So who is doing the local prohibition case? Is it me? Oh, do you
should leave it?
Oh, let's take this out. Ah, we just have to do that. Nope. How do we get out of? Let's figure this out at lunchtime, okay? Peony. Is Peony here for the local prohibition case? I'll get my notes up for the local prohibition case then. So case number four. It's interesting, in the 1870s to the 1890s, prohibition was a really big issue in Canada. The reason being is that we were starting to enter the industrial age, and there was very little social welfare legislation, so there were economic downturns, and liquor was very cheap, and men would spend their money on liquor and not their families, and so there was a lot of pressure for prohibition to keep families together. So in Ontario, the government was under pressure to pass legislation like the Canada Temperance Act, but going further, covering smaller municipalities, because let's say there was there had been a referendum in Fredericton, in New Brunswick, for the whole city, and the whole city went dry. But Toronto was a fairly big municipality, and there were referendums in the whole of the city, and the city didn't want to go dry, but certain parts of the city did. So the Ontario government passed the Local Prohibition Act, which allowed smaller municipalities to hold plebiscites on prohibition, and then if the plebiscite was successful, if people in a smaller area wanted prohibition, the government would then declare prohibition for that smaller area. Well, the Canada Temperance Act has already been upheld by the JCPC as valid federal legislation. So a case got to the Judicial Committee of the Privy Council. The issue was, is the Ontario legislation ultra vires? Is it only the feds that can pass prohibition legislation under public order and safety, subject matter of the legislation? Can the provinces do it also? So, the this decision was written by Lord Watson. Lord Watson was a Scot. Now, he was part of the Judicial Committee of the Privy Council, which was the highest court for the Commonwealth. Scotland is part of the common law world, not part of the civil law world. But because the JCPC, group of five judges, is the highest court of appeal for, well, in those days, the British Empire, a Scot could sit on it. Now, a great deal of research was done into the decisions of Lord Watson and later Viscount Haldane, who was also a Scot, by John Saywell, passed away a year or two ago, famous professor of history here at York University. By the way, York's history department is listed as, I think it's among the 30 best history departments in the world. So John Saywell was part of that tradition. Anyway, by looking at the notes made by John Saywell and his after by Lord Watson and Haldane and their after dinner speeches and so on, Watson and Haldane deliberately tried to decentralize Canada. Because they were Scots, they realized that the United Kingdom would not hold together if there was too much central power in London over the UK. Even more so, Canada was bound to disintegrate if the central government had too much power, because Canada is really diverse. We have two languages, many different cultures, and if power is centralized too much, some of the provinces are just not going to take it and they're going to separate. So that was really Watson's view and Haldane's view later on. So this case gets to the Judicial Committee of the Privy Council. He's the chair of the Judicial Committee of the Privy Council, this group of five judges. He deliberately wants to uphold the provincial legislation. Well, how can he do this given the Russell decision? Well, he says, first of all, the federal government can trench or interfere with provincial power in Section 92 only if that's incidental for a legitimate federal purpose. Otherwise, he said, all of Section 92 could be subsumed under Section 91. We don't want that to happen. So, he talks about Section 94. Now, Section 94, which I didn't talk about last month, is and that's because it's not a very important power anymore, but it was important to Watson. Section 94 says that the common law provinces can get together if they wish to unify the common law, and then it becomes a federal power. I'm sorry, they can get together to unify private law, and then private law becomes a federal power. The provinces aren't going to do that because they really like to have control over private law, over business. But nevertheless, Section 94 is there. Peace, order, and good government is interpreted too broadly to give the federal government jurisdiction over huge aspects of private law, then Section 94 would be meaningless. So Watson says Section 94 means that we have to interpret Section 91, especially peace, order, and good government, somewhat restrictively. So the Ontario government said that its prohibition legislation fell under Section 92, subsection 8, municipalities. Watson wasn't convinced by that argument. So then he goes on and he says, well, we have to define the pith and substance of the Local Prohibition Act. Now, shouldn't it be public order and safety because it's almost word for word the same as the federal act? No, he defines it differently. It's the vice of intemperance at the local level. So it has a different pith and substance than the federal act. So given his definition of the subject matter, the pith and substance of the Local Prohibition Act, does it fall under section 9216? Yes, all matters of a local or private nature. Does it fall under 9213? No, because the law prohibits, it doesn't regulate, or the law allows prohibition of alcohol, not just the regulation of alcohol. Okay, so we have, what he's saying is we have a valid piece of provincial legislation, the Local Prohibition Act, and valid federal legislation, the Canada Temperance Act. Is the federal legislation paramount? In this case, no, because under the doctrine of the conflict of laws, if you can obey both by obeying the strictest, there's no contradiction between the two laws. So, the Canada Temperance Act allowed for a referendum in Toronto. The people of Toronto didn't want prohibition. But then there was another referendum in the Junction. And the Junction voted in favor of prohibition. And the province instituted it for the Junction area. So, is there a contradiction between the two laws? No. You don't drink in the Junction. You can drink elsewhere in Toronto. So because you can logically obey both laws, there's no contradiction. Now, it's really interesting that the prohibition in the Junction area lasted all the way until about 10 years ago. I live in that area, kind of Hyde Park, the Junction. And every 2 years, I've lived there for about 25 years. So every 2 years during the municipal elections, there is a vote on prohibition. And I had a neighbor who went around to everybody. He was retired, so he could go around to everybody in the whole neighborhood and say, vote in favor of prohibition. Before we had prohibition, we had bars on Dundas West, and it was a horrible mess. There were lots of drunken brawls. We don't want that back again. But then he passed away, and in the referendum after that, prohibition was abolished. There were lots of restaurants in the Junction area that wanted to be able to serve alcohol. Anyway, we haven't had drunken brawls, so it's not as bad. And the restaurants have flourished. We have lots of wonderful restaurants. You can come and try them out. But it's interesting that because of this case, the prohibition lasted in that area for all these years. Quite fascinating. So, this particular decision gave rise to the aspect of the double aspect doctrine. A legislative subject matter, like prohibition, can fall under section 91 for one purpose and section 92 for another purpose. And it's interesting that Watson goes on to in obiter, to hint that there's probably a national concern branch of peace, order, and good government. It's not just residual, but if something is of a national concern, it can become a federal matter and the feds can regulate. So later on, the National Capital Commission was created, for example, because it's a matter of national concern. But in this case, he just hints that's one way that peace, order, and government could be interpreted in the future. So any questions about this really fascinating case? Yes?
Okay. In the Canada Temperance Act, does it prohibit at all, or does it just allow for local governments to prohibit in the actual Temperance Act?
In the Canada Temperance Act, it allows for plebiscites in larger municipalities, and if most of the people are in favor, then the federal government may introduce prohibition, which they always did.
Okay. So it doesn't prohibit like this, like as far as like trading or like moving alcohol across the country, it doesn't prohibit any of that.
No. Okay. It just means that you can't have bars or you can't sell liquor within a particular area. Any other questions? I'm not sure if this is in the right order. Let me look at the sign-up sheet. The next case is the Toronto Electric Commissioners versus Snyder. Ah, yes. I just have to go back to my other PowerPoint for that one. This is another fascinating case. That went to the Judicial Committee of the Privy Council. The impugned legislation, that is the legislation being challenged, in this case in the Judicial Committee of the Privy Council, is the Federal Industrial Disputes Investigation Act. So, in the early 1900s, because of the industrialization of parts of Canada, and because labor unions were being enforced, were being formed and there were strikes and so on, there needed to be some regulation of labor. And the first regulation was done at the federal level through the Industrial Disputes Investigation Act. So the question was this federal labor legislation constitutional, given that the provinces are responsible for business under 9213? Now it's really interesting, I mentioned Lord Watson, who decided the local prohibition case. Viscount Haldane was also a Scot, and he was a great friend of Lord Watson, and Lord Watson was his idol, really. Haldane was quite a flamboyant politician before he became a judge. He was actually one of the founders of the London School of Economics. So if you Google Viscount Haldane, you'll find a lot written about him. But he was one of the reasons that he liked Watson so much is that in a number of decisions that Watson made, he decentralized Canada, transferred power really from the central government to the provinces. And Haldane really thought that Watson is responsible for saving Canada, because if we had been too centralized, the country could not have survived. So, I should go into the... So, where does labor legislation fall under Section 92 or Section 91? Well, Haldane first says, clearly it falls under 92.13, property and civil rights. If the provinces control business, under 92.13 they also control labor legislation. Of course, there are certain exceptions with regard to federally regulated industries. The feds can pass legislation. But here we're dealing with the Toronto Electric Commissioner, a forerunner of the TTC. They operated a street railway, an electric street railway in Toronto. And it's a municipal agency. So clearly this falls under provincial jurisdiction, under 92.13, not under federal legislation. So remember the procedure laid out by Sir Montague Smith? You ask, first of all, does it fall under Section 92? Then the next question, does it also fall under Section 91? And the federal government had argued that it falls several places under Section 91. First, under peace, order, and good government, the residual clause. Second, under the federal criminal power, because there are criminal-like sanctions for failing to obey the Industrial Disputes Investigation Act. And third, it falls under Trade and Commerce, 91.2. Haldane rejected all these arguments. It doesn't fall under any of these. And then he goes on to say that peace, order, and good government can be used as a residual power or as an emergency power. So this is the genesis of the emergency doctrine invented by Haldane in this particular case. So although he wanted to decentralize Canada and interpret 92.13 very broadly, he also realized that there are wars that come along, there are emergencies that come along, and the federal government may have to act for the good of the whole country, and if the provinces have too much power during those emergencies, then Canada will fall apart. So the feds can legislate during emergencies under peace, order, and good government. But in this particular situation, there's no emergency. So therefore, the provinces regulate labor legislation under 92.13 in this particular case. And also he talks about specific words taking precedence over general words, as in previous cases. So, how can this decision be squared with the Russell case? Well, Haldane says there must have been an emergency in 1878. The evil of intemperance was one so great that Parliament intervened to protect the nation from disaster. So, in other words, in 1878, there must have been an epidemic of drunkenness. And that's why the feds legislated the Canada Temperance Act to save the nation from disaster. Is there any evidence there is an epidemic of drunkenness in 1878? But according to stare decisis, Haldane could not overrule the Russell case. The Russell case seemed to say the Canada Temperance Act is valid federal legislation under peace, order, and good government. So Haldane says, well, I'm not overruling Russell, but there must have been an emergency then. This particular, I think that Haldane meant this to be part of the holding in terms of his interpretation of peace, order, and good government. Later on, the Supreme Court, well, even the Judicial Committee of the Privy Council and the Supreme Court of Canada future cases said, this is just obiter, and besides which, he was wrong. There was no epidemic of drunkenness. The Russell case is good law. Any questions about the Snyder case? Or comments? So one thing that my students always find perplexing is that before they took a course like this, they thought that judges interpret the law, following precedents is very clear, and it's very, very logical. And in many ways, we don't need judges. We just plug the precedents into a computer. The computer spits out the right answers. That's not the case.
Just a comment, I think. Mm-hmm. It demonstrates, with respect to Haldane, the fallibility of the judiciary at times. And mm-hmm. Something we have to understand.
Well, and first of all, there have been debates about these series of cases over the years in Canada. I think there was a fellow by the name of Brown that wrote a book saying that there's no contradiction. The judges followed precedent all the way through if you read the cases really carefully. It's just, yeah, maybe there appears to be a contradiction, but it isn't really the case. Other people like Alan Cairns and Peter Russell have said, look, clearly their judges did not follow precedent properly. But thank goodness they didn't, because Haldane was right. Canada would be too centralized if they'd followed precedent properly, and we probably wouldn't have survived as a nation. And then other people have said, it's really too bad that they didn't follow precedent, because we do need to be more centralized. We're one of the most decentralized federations in the world, partly because of these decisions. This means that Canada is not as strong in the international stage as we could be if we were more centralized. So this debate will go on forever. You had a question or comment.
Well, it's just part of what I was saying. Mm-hmm. I just find it really interesting how things do shift, though, right? Like, mm-hmm. As times change, as there's economic shift, I even would say, even though, you know, there's supposed to be the impartiality, there's still that piece in terms of what was going on in the country at that time. Mm-hmm. And just in sort of looking at my cases over time, too, as it's shifted, how, you know, There was diversity. There was diversity in the population and all that. But now, with it becoming mm-hmm. even more complex, how more complex it's even gotten for like the Supreme Court of Canada. Mm-hmm. So it's just interesting how some of that, those values and those pieces, still do become entrenched in our case law.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, that's absolutely right. One of the fellows of McLaughlin College is Michael Tulloch. Who was the first black judge on the Ontario Superior Court, is now the first black judge on the Ontario Court of Appeal. And he spoke to this class last year, and he said, what do judges do? Well, they take into account the living tree doctrine, that Canada is changing, and the Constitution has to be interpreted as a living tree in accordance with the times. Judges can't be too radical about this, because we pay our lawyers good money to predict the outcome of judicial decisions. But as you'll see in these cases, judges begin to realize that times are changing. Next month, when we talk about the Charter of Rights and Freedoms in the labor relations cases, to begin with, in the 1980s, the judges said the Charter of Rights does not protect the right to strike. And then in the early 2000s, they began to say, well, maybe governments can go a little bit too far. There is a bit of a charter protection here. And then two or three years ago, they went even further, and they said there is a limited protection of the right to strike. So, any other questions or comments? So, Ron, you're going to do the labor conventions case? Just before we get into that, I just wanted to say a few things about treaty making cases, and then we'll do the labor conventions case, which is the most important of those cases. And then while you're setting up, you folks can get coffee and so on. Then after your presentation, we'll go upstairs to lunch. And we'll have first dibs before the other class. Does that sound okay? Okay. So, the treaty signing power, the treaty implementation power, are two different powers. I think I mentioned that briefly in September. So until 1926, the federal government had the treaty signing power, as long as they didn't contradict British Empire treaties, and the treaty implementation power, because they could implement British Empire treaties under Section 132 of the BNA Act. But in 1926, the Balfour Declaration was passed that said that Canada is equal in status to the United Kingdom, and that was thanks to the terrific contribution the Canadians made during the First World War, which probably would have been lost by the Allies had it not been for the Canadian contribution. And then this was put into law in the Statute of Westminster in 1931. So because of the Statute of Westminster, Section 132 became obsolete. So the Statute of Westminster is part of our Constitution, part of our written Constitution. Section 132 is obsolete. It's no longer part of our Constitution. So, the aeronautics case came to the Judicial Committee of the Privy Council in 1932, right after the Statute of Westminster. So, Section 132 is no longer there. Canada was implementing a British Empire treaty by passing aeronautics legislation, regulating aeronautics in Canada. Was the federal legislation intravirus? Was it valid? And the Judicial Committee of the Privy Council said yes. There are several heads under Section 91 where the feds can regulate aeronautics. Defense, post office because of airmail and so on. So even though Section 132 is gone, the feds can still implement that particular treaty, even though it interferes with provincial jurisdiction in some ways. Then the next case was the radio case in Section 1 in 1932. And if you read that case carefully, it says treaty making and treaty implementation powers are new because Section 132 is gone. So we have a new power, treaty making and treaty implementation. Because it's a new power, it falls under peace, order, and good government. It's a residual, the residual power. And therefore, the feds can regulate radio broadcasting because treaty making and treaty implementation is new. Now, when we get to your case, Ron, you'll see that the court reinterpreted what they said in the radio case. They said radio is new, not treaty implementation powers. And that's why the feds could regulate radio, because the radio power is new. So from my view, there's a clear departure from precedence there. Brown would disagree in some way. I don't know how, but so that's just kind of setting up your presentation. Now, extraterritoriality. It's recognized under international law that any sovereign state has extraterritorial jurisdiction. That is, you can pass laws that apply not only within your sovereign state, but outside of the state, if you can enforce them. So that's why, for example, the United States government has passed laws saying that no one can trade with Cuba. And if a Canadian trades with Cuba and is unlucky enough to go to the U.S. and get arrested, they could be tried in the United States for trading with Cuba. If someone hijacks a Canadian aircraft anywhere in the world, that's illegal under Canadian law. And if we can get them here for a trial, we can prosecute them. War criminals anywhere in the world can be tried in Canada, as some of the war criminals from Rwanda have been. But the provinces don't have extraterritorial power. They can't enact laws that apply outside of the province or internationally, unless there's just an incidental effect of those laws to other provinces. We'll be talking about that later. And treaties can be made. There are three types of treaties. Head of state treaties, where the, for example, our Governor General would sign a treaty with the head of state of another country. Intergovernmental treaties, where the government, a cabinet minister would sign a treaty on behalf of Canada with a counterpart in another country. An exchange of notes, that is diplomatic notes. And that's what happened with regard to negotiating Omer Khadr coming back to Canada. There was an exchange of diplomatic notes. The point is, regardless of how treaties or agreements are made, they're equally valid under international law. So, any questions about that before we go to Ron's presentation? Great. Come on up, Ron, and you can grab some coffee if you'd like. Do you have a presentation? Oh, great. I'll let you get it up. Oh, just a second. We've got to get rid of this other one first.
I should be able to get through.
Here's another one. There we go.
I'm sorry. So just some news from the student executive.
We were thinking of implementing a library workshop for MPAL, right? We were thinking of doing it on a Saturday, sometime after this class. We're gonna try to, you know, discuss with professors, see what the deal is. But it's basically, it will be a workshop for like assignments. So stuff that you guys might not be used to. Things like, you know, teaching us how to write briefing notes, or, you know, how to do like proper research for, you know, a policy research paper, something, you know, not everybody might know how to do. So I just wanted, you know, your feedback on whether or not you'd be, you know, interested in something like this, you know, and a library workshop. It would be on a Saturday.
We've often done this in the past, actually.
So,
you know. Next month?
It would probably be next month, yeah. So November 17th, I believe.
I'd be very interested.
Sorry? It would be one workshop sometime after class. So
I don't think we'd have it after class.
No?
No, because it's usually a different day, mm-hmm. a different Saturday, and it usually just goes 2 or 3 hours.
We were thinking of doing it on the Saturday we have class. That mm-hmm. way everybody would already be here instead of, you know, coming from another day, you know, because we know it's you know, it's difficult to get down here sometimes. So we were thinking about it. I don't know if it's going to, like, I'll let you guys know for sure if it goes through, but I just want to let you guys know, like, we're thinking about it, thinking about you guys, you know.
It's feasible if we started the class at 9 a.m. Mm-hmm. instead of 10. Would that be an option? Is there anybody who couldn't get here by 9?
I'm good with that.
Yes, sure.
Okay, we'll talk about that then.
A sheet around if we can sign up?
No. If you guys want, it's open to everybody. If you guys want to come, just by all means, you're always welcome. And if you guys have any like concerns that you want to address, you know, like certain assignments or certain topics you want discussed in these workshops, just come to me and I'll give it to the student council. All right.
Hey, Carmen, question for you. I've attended some workshops already. And there are some instances where these types of webinars or sessions are not necessarily accommodated for that's working full time.
Yeah, that's
usually they run around 11 to 2 or whatnot. I did make a suggestion with the librarian Patty Ryan whether or not some of these workshops can be available via webinar. Would that be something that you would consider for?
I'll definitely bring it up with them.
Right.
Yeah. We're like the whole purpose of these workshops is to, we're trying to, you know, be like considerate of everybody. You know, trying to get everybody there because we know it's hard for you guys, right?
Right.
So yeah, just let me know if you guys have any topics you want to discuss for sure.
All right. Awesome. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Ron. Labor conventions.
All right. Well, good morning, everyone. My name is Ron Lucero, and today I will be speaking about the Attorney General of Canada versus the Attorney General Ontario Labour Conventions case back in 1937. What I'll do is I've broken down this presentation. First, I'll talk about the facts and then dive into the issues, the decisions that the court made, and also the judicial reasoning around those decisions. And lastly, I'd like to have some class involvement about a discussion question. So I put together two specific questions, and I'd like to know what your thoughts are with regards to this specific case. So the facts about this case: in 1935, Canada ratified 3 conventions that was presented by the International Labour Organization. Now, this case itself was quite different than the other case that we read in back in week 1 and week 2, in that regards that there is an international aspect to this particular case. So it's not specifically just federal, provincial, and municipal, if that be, but rather there's an extra element of the international context here. So what the International Labour Organization presented to the Parliament were 3 particular acts, and one was the Weekly Rest Industrial Undertakings Act, the Minimum Wage Act, and lastly, the Limitations of Hours Work Act.
facts are that the province of Ontario challenged and claimed that this was ultra virus. It was certainly unconstitutional from their view. And what I'll go through now is the main issue of the case. What I thought was the main issue was the legislation passed by the parliament, presented by the International Labour Organization, compliant, and was it beyond the authority outlined in Canada's constitution? The main issue, the decision was that the federal government was beyond jurisdiction to pass this particular legislation. So emphasizing that the federal government was actually beyond its scope of its powers. As stated by Lord Atkin, he quotes on saying, Canada cannot become a party to an international agreement that requires legislative action unless the prior approval of the provinces is first secured. I thought that was a valuable quote directly from Russell's book. I thought it cleared the case, what this case was about, what the issue was, and how Lord Atkin made its decision. I thought that was fairly clear of this particular quote by him. And then the judicial reasoning around it was, although Section 132, the treaty obligation, states that the Parliament and Government of Canada shall have all powers, it was determined by the judicial court that it was within the power of the province to pass this treaty under Section 92 rather than by the federal government, Section 91. The federal government does not have the authority to particularly pass this treaty. Now, two questions I've placed there on the board are, do you think the federal government under Section 91 have the right to impose treaty obligations? And number two to that is, how does the power of good government, Section 91, play a role here? If so, what? So here's something to stimulate your mind. Think of emergency or foreign aids that Canada had to help other countries or provinces. Think of the 9/11. Think of the Haiti earthquake. So what are your thoughts around it, about this particular question? Yes?
Anyway, when you're talking about treaty obligations and international laws that were ratifying at international conferences, I think that the federal government should have the right to impose them, just because we have very different provinces, cough, cough, Quebec, who will mess everything up for everyone else and say that they don't want it, so nobody can have it. So I feel like there should be, like the federal government should be able to act in the interest of all the provinces, and then maybe, you know, Quebec can opt out later. So I do believe that it should be that they should have a right to do this under Section 91.
Jamal?
It kind of raises two questions. First of all, is that if Canada is a federal state that has a constitutional power to that allows the federal government to act. Number two, what is the role of our provinces when some of them claim that they have just a compact between two nations? So if they claim that, then we have other nations in this country, and if they claim that it's between nations, so then it challenges the first question that Canada itself is a compact between multi-nations. So if federal government is going to do whatever it wants to do outside of this country, then then these provinces and these nations don't have any input in it. So there has to be some mechanism in the constitution. So I think Professor can.
Yeah, and just to add on to that point as well, I think there's certainly
a balanced approach between the federal and the provincial government. There certainly needs to be, when you talk about from the public administration perspective of formulating and implementing and evaluating policies and so forth, that's a two-way street between the federal and the provincial government. But also, when I was reading this case, honestly, the first assumption I had was, oh, when I see the acronym POGG, I said, okay, the federal gets it. But not entirely. In this case, it was ruled that this ruling was not necessarily an emergency, so to speak, what the federal government would stipulate. So yes.
The compact theory. Let me just say a few words about that because many of you haven't heard about it. Up until the late 70s, early 1980s, one of the theories of Canadian Confederation is that Confederation was a compact between Francophones and Anglophones. And so both of these groups deserved to be treated equally and would have equal input into future constitutional amendments. And that was discussed quite a bit in the couple of years leading up to the constitutional amendments of 1982. It was the Aboriginal Canadians that really destroyed that theory. They said, well, gee, what about us? We were here first. As I mentioned earlier, had it not been for their contribution to the War of 1812, we'd all be part of the United States today. So if there's a compact, it must be at least three peoples. And then, of course, all the other new Canadians say, well, what about us? So the compact theory is not discussed very much anymore. I think one of the main points of this case is that in the Snyder case, the Judicial Committee of the Privy Council said labor relations is a provincial responsibility, primarily with regard to federally regulated industries like the nuclear industry and so on, interprovincial railways, then it's federal. But with regard to just about everything else, it's provincial. But the International Labor Convention could be used to give the federal government jurisdiction over all labor relations. And they thought, you know, it was never, we can't interpret it that way because of the way we've already interpreted Section 9213. So the treaty making power is a new power under peace, order, and good government. But treaty implementation depends on whether it's federal or provincial jurisdiction. One of your questions was, should that be changed? Should treaty implementation also be a federal responsibility, like it is in Australia, for example? Whether it should be or not, how could it be changed? Treaty implementation. Yes?
Through a formal constitutional amendment?
We'd have to have a formal constitutional amendment. And I think it's the 750 formula that would apply. And then there would be compensation for opting out if some provinces opted out.
Yeah.
So that would be complex. So it's never going to happen. And this decision is so important, I don't think it's ever going to be overruled by the JCPC. The emergency doctrine still applies in times of war or other epidemics of drunkenness. The feds can trench on provincial responsibilities. Or the other thing is, you know, a national health disaster, like SARS.
Yes.
The feds can intervene. But as soon as the emergency is over, they have to withdraw. Yes?
I just had a quick question. How is that defined?
Which emergency?
Right. Like, how is that defined?
We'll get into that this afternoon when we talk about the anti-inflation case. Any other questions or comments about labor conventions? Isn't our Constitution fascinating?
I do have another comment, and it's more specific to the Canada Health Act. You just mentioned about the SARS epidemic. Certainly, if the federal and provincial government plays a huge role in that, and also at the same time, if you look at our current existing environment right now, where resources are so constrained, specifically the funding around healthcare, that there is that balancing act of how do you still continue to maintain that quality of service from the provincial level, mm-hmm. and at the same time from across the country, mm-hmm. right? So it's quite fascinating when I read this case. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Health is a provincial responsibility. And the only reason that the feds are involved is because of the spending power.
Yes.
But they can pull a lot of strings through the spending power. There have been so many editorials and articles in the newspapers the last few weeks about the crisis in healthcare. And it's just the current situation is unsustainable. I'm going to retire next year, and I'm going to cost all you folks a lot of money as I get older. And when I'm 100 years old, if I live to be that long, I'm going to be costing you a huge amount of money. Is that fair? It's not sustainable. We have yet to figure out solutions. Any other questions or comments before we go to lunch? Okay, so you can keep your laptops in here if you want to make sure that the door is locked, and try to be back here at 1 o'clock, maybe a bit before 1 because we're leaving a little bit before 12. But for the people who are presenting after lunch, if you want to bring your presentations up now, if you have PowerPoint, we'll put them on the system now. I'll try to get everything out here. Good. That's one. That you can take yours out.
I'll grab Jamal's.
And that's, yeah.
Okay. Thank you.
Jamal's is out. Good.
All right, thank you very much. Yeah, the healthcare, actually, I'm working in the Ministry of Health. That's exactly what we're talking about. Mm-hmm. How does this continue to maintain a sharp quality of service?
Very few.
Quite fascinating because the health system is more of a test than cash.
Good luck.